somehow. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyyil azim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina abil qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin. La siyama baqiyyatillahi fil al-aradin. أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. We've been studying different features of the community of Ahlul Bayt عليهم السلام, and after studying the necessity of being balanced, being truthful, being united, we talked about the necessity of observing the rights of each mu'min, and we said there are lots of rights that mu'minin should observe, and these are indeed to keep the community together and form a very solid, united community, like one body, as Rasulullah said, that the example of mu'minin in their love, in their sympathy, in their affection is like one jasad. مثل المؤمنين في توادهم وتراحمهم وتعاطفهم كمثل جسد. It's like one body, different cells and organs of the same body. I want now to move on to another characteristic of the community of Ahlul Bayt, and that is to do Amr al-Ma'ruf and Nahy al-Munkar. مؤمنين need advice, need support. Sometimes brothers ask, sisters ask, you know, what should we say to people about Imam Hussein when we want to introduce Imam Hussein? Of course, you know, we can say Imam Hussein was thirsty, children were mistreated. These are very important. But the main thing is this point. Why Imam Hussein was ready to go to all these difficulties and troubles for himself and his family? Because he wanted to give a lesson to all of us. Not only as Muslims or as Shia, as all human beings, that when you see haq is ignored, when you see justice is ridiculed, when you see crimes are being done with the good names, under, you know, good names, hypocrisy, dishonesty is there, that is the time to do something to reform. Otherwise, you will be also counted as one of those corrupt people. Imam Hussein alayhi salam also said, as you know, this famous hadith, he quoted from Rasulullah, "Man ra'a sultanan ja'iran." Whoever sees that there is an unjust king, ruler, who disregards the covenant of Allah, who treats people with zulm, who doesn't observe Allah's regulations, وَلَمْ يُقَيِّرْ عَلَيْهِ, and doesn't protest, doesn't object, بِقَوْلٍ, either by word or fail, كَانَ حَقًّا عَلَى اللَّهِ أَنْ يُدْخِلَهُ مُدْخَلَهُ, Allah has the right to put him in the same place that he puts that person in hell. كَانَ حَقًّا عَلَى اللَّهِ أَنْ يُدْخِلَهُ مُدْخَلَهُ. So if we keep silent and we don't do anything to stop battle, to stop zulm, we are also responsible. So we have to be saying this to the people about Imam Hussein. And I'm sure then every person who wants to reform his society, I don't know, his country, then would be very much looking for getting inspiration from Imam Hussein alayhi salam, giving reference, courage, support from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Because Imam Hussein alayhi salam, as I explained, did something which was for humanity, not only for Muslims. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. One of the things that, inshallah, maybe I get time to explain is that before Imam Hussein, there was always a problem. And also after Imam Hussein, most of the time there's a problem. People try to justify differences by saying that these are different interpretations. Why Imam Ali alayhi salam was not given the right of Khilafah? They say, you know, there was misunderstanding, there was no agreement. People had different views. Why Muawiyah stood against Imam Ali? So he did ijtihad. He did his own ijtihad. Imam Ali did his own ijtihad. You know, all the things, you know, they justified. They say this was different understanding, different interpretation of Islam. So they try to make everything very much, you know, maintained and contained within different ijtihad and, you know, personal opinions and these type of things. Also, when you say what happened to other people, they also say this is internal issue. What happened between Imam Ali and, for example, Muawiyah or, you know, others? They say, okay, this is a problem inside Islam. Like what happens today. Today, unfortunately, there are many important issues for humanity, but many people try to say this is Sunni-Shia conflict. It's a big, you know, big crime, big zulm. There is no issue of Sunni-Shia. This is issue of haq, batil, zulm, adala. Of course, maybe there is no 100% haq on this side and 100% batil on that side. But you have to understand the general picture. But people want to say, no, this is Sunni-Shia conflict. So many things that have happened in the history, also they say the same. If Imam Kazim alayhi salam was killed by Harun, they say this was personal, internal problem between Muslims. There is nothing interesting for rest of humanity. But in the case of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the situation became so obvious. And the contrast between Imam and his army and Yazid and his army was so sharp that it's no longer possible for anyone to say this was because of different interpretation of Islam or because this was an internal issue among Muslims. No. This is the contrast between haq and batil, between virtues and vices, between zulm and adl. And this is why you see even Hindus have sympathy with Imam Hussein. If it was, you know, something based on different understanding of Islam, Hindus say, you know, this is your own business. It's not my business. You see, Hindus, Christians, Sikhs, Zoroastrians, all have sympathy with Imam Hussein. Why? Because it has become an issue for humanity. Now we need to have this insight to continue this process and show Imam Hussein's values to the people of the world in the way that they can understand and they can appreciate as an issue for humanity, not only for the Shia, as something that all humanity can learn and benefit from. So this is what we have to do.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
O Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. O Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and all Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again. Let's become
the light.
Hello.
Welcome to The Light. As the COVID-19 pandemic has affected most sectors in one way or another, a Swiss tech firm has created a robot that can disinfect airplanes in a few minutes. The startup called Uvea says the robot emits powerful ultraviolet lights as it slowly moves down the aisle, killing 99% of bacteria and pathogens, including the coronavirus. The company says a robot can disinfect a single aisle in 13 minutes. The startup co-founder says the UVC technology has been used for decades in hospitals and labs. He says the fact that the rays could be harmful to humans prompted them to seek an autonomous robot that can carry out the task.
It's quite an old technology, but it's quite dangerous. That's why we want to take the worker out of the range of the light. So that's why we made a robot, because there is some solution when you are near the light, and that's dangerous. So we really had to make this system autonomous. So we switch it on, we leave, the machine makes the disinfection, all the plane, all around, and then it stops automatically. So the worker are not in contact with the machine.
The company is hopeful that technology could help restore travelers' confidence in safe air travel and help bring the worst-hit aviation sector back to its feet. Painting eggs is a beloved tradition amongst Christians, especially Orthodox, on the occasion of Easter, symbolizing the resurrection of Jesus Christ. A veteran Hungarian artist has taken that craft to a whole new level. 67-year-old Tunde Chuhai has been designing eggs for decades. Each of her delicate creations takes days to make. Chuhai uses various kinds of eggs and says the best one comes from geese. She starts her craft by emptying the eggs through tiny pinholes before washing and then drawing patterns on them. The veteran egg designer says her style is so unique that she doesn't have to sign her eggs.
I never sign my eggs, as everyone knows they were done by me. I don't have to particularly prove that I did it, because my style is so distinctive, even though others may use similar techniques.
Chuhai's decorative Easter eggs are very popular, so she has to work all year round to meet the demands. Her work is internationally recognized and has featured in galleries both at home and abroad. This year, however, her miniature creations have to stay at home with her due to the coronavirus pandemic. A young British man who is no stranger to danger takes his life in his hands, free climbing one of the highest skyscrapers in Europe. George King made his way to the top of a 116-meter hotel in the Spanish city of Barcelona without any ropes or safety measures. The 21-year-old scaled the building in only about 20 minutes. However, as he was climbing down the building, he was arrested by police. This is not the first time the British daredevil has risked his life with such a nail-biting climb. Last December, he scaled Barcelona's iconic Agbar Tower with a height of 144 meters. In 2019, he also free-climbed the 310-meter Shard building in London. The feat, however, earned him 6 months in a young offenders centre.
A chocolate maker in the Belgian city of Bruges has come up with a novel recipe to boost business in the run-up to Easter.
When you're a classic chocolate maker, make very classic recipes. Caramels, praline, marzipan, and it's okay. We have classic bonbons too. But I think today, the customer wants to go on adventure, also when they are eating something.
The chocolatier's special concoction is a praline made of grass juice, Granny Smith apples, and an East Asian type of lemon. He believes chocolate contains a secret ingredient that can counter the lockdown gloom. Belgium is known as the chocolate capital of the world. The northern city of Bruges is in particular renowned for treating your taste buds to quality cocoa. However, the coronavirus pandemic has diminished foreign tourist numbers, with businesses now relying on local customers. This is heart-melting. A video of a stray cat carrying her sick newborn kitten to a veterinary clinic in Turkey is melting hearts online. Veterinarians were confused as a cat walked into their clinic clutching one of her kittens in her mouth. The cat then meowed for a long time and brought in a second kitten of hers. After a quick examination, the vets noticed that the kittens couldn't open their eyes due to an eye infection. The clinic staff immediately treated the animals, helping them open their eyes after a while. The stray feline and her kittens were placed in adoption after the completion of their treatment. In the heart of one of the oldest districts in the U.S. state of California, there's a historical little printing house that is receiving a new lease on life. The building and its equipment were slowly dying out, and its machines were good for scrap. The iconic printing house was on the verge of bankruptcy until a group of artists revived this beacon of traditional typography. They used what was already present in the building, including the tools and hand printing knowledge. Artists are able to print their new age designs using these old printing methods. Some of the machines date back to the late 1800s. La Linterna was first founded to print newspapers. Later on, it began printing cinema and concert posters for famous artists. Nothing marks the start of spring in Japan like cherry blossoms. This year, people try to enjoy the sakura season safely by observing health protocols. Scores of Japanese have flocked to Tokyo's Ueno Park and along the Magura River to see stunning cherry trees in full bloom. The light pink flowers symbolize fresh starts in Japanese culture. The cherry blossoms generally last from April to May. Thanks to this year's warmer weather, trees have blossomed earlier than usual. However, the number of people coming out to enjoy the season has fallen sharply due to the coronavirus pandemic. Some sakura festivals around the capital were also canceled.
In the heart of one of the oldest districts in the U.S. state of California, there is a historical little printing house that is receiving a new lease on life. The building and its equipment were slowly dying out, and its machines were good for scrap. The iconic printing house was on the verge of bankruptcy until a group of artists revived this beacon of traditional typography. They used what was already present in the building, including the tools and hand printing knowledge. artists are able to print their new age designs using these old printing methods. Some of the machines date back to the late 1800s. La Linterna was first founded to print newspapers. Later on, it began printing cinema and concert posters for famous artists. Nothing marks the start of spring in Japan like cherry blossoms. This year, people try to enjoy the sakura season safely by observing health protocols. Scores of Japanese have flocked to Tokyo's Ueno Park and along the Meguro River to see stunning cherry trees in full bloom. The light pink flowers symbolize fresh starts in Japanese culture. The cherry blossoms generally last from April to May. Thanks to this year's warmer weather, trees have blossomed earlier than usual. However, the number of people coming out to enjoy the season has fallen sharply due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Some sakura festivals around the capital, Tokyo, were also cancelled. Asia's largest tulip garden has opened its doors to the public in the Indian-administered Kashmir. The event is expected to draw tens of thousands of enthusiasts this year after witnessing only few visitors last year following the COVID-19 lockdown. Shahanabad has more.
In between the foothills of the Zabarwan mountain range and the world-famous Dal Lake, Asia's largest tulip garden is now open to the public. Visitors are mesmerized by all the colorful flowers which are on display at the event. This seasonal exhibit is a major attraction for locals as well as tourists visiting this picturesque Himalayan region this time around.
People of Kashmir are eagerly awaiting spring because winters here are tough. For us, Navroz of the Persian New Year festival brings hope. And these flowers are the proof of the spring season. They please the eye and fill us with fresh energy.
In this garden, there are 51 different types of tulips, and caretakers of this garden work hard throughout the year to make sure the flowers bloom well.
This garden is God's grace, and to add to its beauty, we, a team of gardeners, are working year-round. We become delighted when we see visitors from different corners of the world come here to enjoy this beauty. It's a matter of pride for us when they compliment us on our hard work.
Amid the coronavirus pandemic, the number of tourists visiting Kashmir has drastically reduced. Now, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has taken to Twitter and urged Indian citizens to visit Kashmir's tulip garden.
Kashmir is a heaven on earth. This is what we had heard, but now we believe it. I have never seen so many flowers together. The beauty of this place is mind-blowing.
Kashmir, a tourism-dependent economy, has long been affected by the ongoing turmoil in the region, and now the coronavirus pandemic has added to the miseries of people here. However, people are hoping against the hope that sooner or later the region will witness lasting peace and prosperity. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today.
We've begun discussing monotheism and the divine attributes in the last few episodes. Shiite scholars believe that God is one, in contrast to other religions such as Christianity.
He's completely immaterial being.
We don't believe that in the Trinity and that there's three dimensions to God, Holy Spirit, Jesus, and God.
We don't believe that he's a physical body. Also, in contrast to other sects in Islam, within Islam, Shiism doesn't believe that God is a physical body. We believe that he has absolute power, he has absolute knowledge. Also, the verses of the Holy Quran in which physical attributes have been ascribed to God, such as having a hand, and so on and so forth, we don't take these literally. We interpret them in a different way, in contrast to other sects within Islam. This is very important, and we're going to be repeating this throughout all of our episodes. It's necessary to make this clear. So even if you see such expressions as the hand of God, it's important not to take this literally, because God doesn't have human-like characteristics such as a physical body. Today we're going to be examining a very important question that people often ask, and that's this. That in these very basic books about Islam, as well as advanced books about Islamic doctrine, we see that in a section on the discussion on God, specifically in the section on the discussion on his attributes and his beautiful names, we see that some of our scholars have divided God's attributes into a couple of categories. There's different divisions for his attributes. One of these divisions is the division of his attributes into his attributes, into attributes which are positive and attributes which are negative. So this sometimes leads to a question in the minds of the person who comes into contact with such a division. Somebody might say that we know that God is absolute perfection, and it's impossible for him to be lacking any perfection. Otherwise, he would be obviously limited and imperfect, and such a being, you know, it's not possible for such a being to be God. It goes against the very definition of God and the concept of what God is. So the question that arises here is this, that what then do these negative attributes mean? What are we exactly negating from God when we say that he is not a physical body, he cannot be seen, he is not in any place, he doesn't have a hand, he doesn't have an eye, and so on and so forth. This objection could be exasperated and could be reinforced when we take into consideration the fact that in human beings and in other creatures of God, these things are actually perfections. These are perfections for us. It's good for me to be in school, in a certain place. It's a perfection for me. If I wasn't there, I would be imperfect, for example. Or if there was something that actually has a physical body, it's more perfect than a being that doesn't even exist. So this might give rise to a question, and that question is that what exactly are we negating when we negate these qualities and these attributes from God? The answer to this question is that it's true. Then when we predicate these things for God's creatures, they do imply a certain perfection. For example, being in a certain place implies being present there, existing in that place, or it might also necessitate having knowledge of the place where the person is or the things that are surrounding the person in that place. When we negate something from God, we're negating the dimensions of imperfection that stem from that attribute. Like, for example, when we say that a certain thing exists in a certain place, it also, not only does it imply that this thing is present and exists in that place, it also implies that it's not present in another place, which is an imperfection. So the thing that we're negating from God in this, and when we negate this thing, this attribute or this quality from God, is this dimension of imperfection. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the meanings of the negative attributes of God. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome. and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salaam Alaikum. Now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I would like to actually talk about this issue of ghibat, especially keeping this issue of COVID-19 pandemic in mind. COVID-19 pandemic has created the environment where people are not able to meet or work with one another. Not only schools and colleges, non-essential workplace and shops, but also places of worship have been closed fully, or if they are open, they are open with restrictions. Not only that, people are not able to meet their own extended family members, but they also miss out the social aspect of gatherings in our religious centers. It has been a year since we haven't been able to have normal gatherings. I miss you all, and many people have written or even called me to say that they also miss seeing me personally. And of course, I miss you all personally also. Although we cannot see one another or attend the programs in the centers, but the new technology has given us the ability to have virtual programs. At the least, we can see the speakers and reciters on the screen and do the rituals virtually. I would like us to look at this 1 year's extraordinary experience and to relate that to the 70 years of the era of Ghaybat al-Sughra. What is Al-Ghaybat al-Sughra? This refers to the minor occultation which marked the first phase of the imamate of the present imam. And during this stage of partial Ghaybat, the imam was not seen by the public. However, he was in touch with his followers through his special representatives, whom he was able to see face to face. In all, as we know, there were four special representatives, one after another. From the year 260 to 280, we had Uthman bin Sa'id al-Amri. Then from 280 to the year 305, we had Muhammad bin Uthman bin Sa'id al-Amri. Then from year 305 to 326, we had Abu al-Qasim al-Husayn bin Rawh. And then when we look at the year 326 to 329, we have Ali bin Muhammad al-Sumari. In all this era of the four spatial representatives known as An-Nawab al-Arba'a comes to about 69 years. And so the spatial representatives, these were the four of them, but they had many regional representatives working under each one of them. The Shias during this Ghaybat al-Sughra were in touch with their local representatives, who would then, and then they would submit their questions and religious dues to their local representatives, who would then take it to the special Naib and representative of their own time, who in turn will take that to the Imam alayhi salam himself directly. And from the Imam, he will get the answers. And sometimes the answers, which were known as tawqi'at, sometimes the answers were given orally, but very often they were actually given in written form. And these written forms of answers were known as at-tawqi'at, the tawqi', which had the signature of the Imam and even the handwriting of the Imam. The followers could not see the Imam directly, but they still found some comfort through these indirect communications. And the interesting point is that the Shias did not, at that time when they were getting the communications from the Imams in the written form, the Shias noticed that the signatures and the handwritings were all of the same style, although they were issued under the term of different representatives, which continued for nearly 70 years. So whether it was the tawqi', which was issued during the time of the first Naib, or the second Naib, or the third Naib, or the fourth Naib, the Shias, they knew that the signature is always the same, and even the handwriting is the same. It is only after the death of the fourth spatial representative that the Ghaybat-e-Kubra, the major or the complete occultation, started. And during this era of Ghaybat-e-Sughra, there were no more spatial representatives. But of course, the Imams had instituted a system that we have general representatives in form of the jurists, the Mujtahideen and Fuqaha, from our community, who are known not only for their knowledge and their fiqahat, but also for their upright character and righteousness. This is a very important element. There is not only knowledge, but their loyalty to the faith, as well as their upright character and righteousness, are very important. The great scholar of this century, Shaheed Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, has a booklet known as An Inquiry Concerning Al-Mahdi. This is the English translation, Bahas Hawl Al-Mahdi, where he describes this phenomenon of Ghaybat-e-Sughra very interestingly. He says Ghaybat-e-Sughra phenomenon is a scientific experience of the community which confirms the actual and factual existence of Imam Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala farajul sharif. Let me give you his quotation with my explanation in there. Basically, he's writing, he says, by looking at the phenomenon of Ghaybat al-Sughra, you can clearly realize that al-Mahdi is a reality that a community had lived through and that has manifested through the representatives of the Imam for 70 years in which they interacted with the people. And no one suspected any one of these representatives of playing on words or changing their dealings with the people or wearing out of the message. In other words, all through the 70 years, the process was same during the terms of the four representatives. Shaheed Baqir al-Sadr continues and he says, for can you imagine by your Lord that the lie could survive for nearly 70 years, which four individuals would successively contend and agree upon and continue to interact with others on its basis, and as if it were a reality that they lived upon, in such a way that nothing was detected from them that could have caused the doubt whether there was no, especially while we realized that there was no particular relationship between the four of them. Only the first and the second one were father and son, but the third and the fourth were not related to one another or to the first or the second. And so when we realized that, you know, how could this lie survive for nearly 70 years, while there was no particular relationship between the four of them which could facilitate conspiracy among them, and they gained their activities the trust and belief of everyone in the community in the reality that they claimed to have felt and lived within. And this is where we had to realize, you know, then Shahid Baqir al-Sadr then says, if you look at logic based on the theory of probability, you will come to realize that it confirms that it is impossible that a lie could survive in this way for so long with all the interaction and give and take while gaining trust of all in this matter. End of quotation. So basically, this phenomenon of Ghaibat al-Sughra, almost 70 years experience that the community went through, where they were not able to see their imam except through these four Naibin, this itself is a very important and a scientific, actually, experience and proof that the imam existed. It is not possible that a lie could be sustained, you know, continuously for 70 years through four different representatives who were dealing with the community on a regular basis. And this is what I'm saying, that when we look at our own COVID-19 situation and the difficulty that we have in, you know, seeing one another or communicating with one another, you know, look at our own situation, and you will be able to relate to the circumstances through which the Shia community went through during this 70 years of indirect link with their Imam Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matin. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صابر مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
the subcontinent. This is your host, John, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the recent ceasefire agreement between India and Pakistan that has brought back relative peace along the disputed border areas. Then we will explore the reverberations of the New Deal in the domestic and foreign politics of the two countries, as well as its numerous repercussions for the geopolitical future of Asia.
India and Pakistan have recently issued a joint statement to announce that they will strictly observe all of their agreements on ceasefire along the so-called line of control and other disputed areas. This was the first joint statement in nearly 20 years. Historically, whenever ceasefires are announced via different statements, they tend to fail. But a joint statement by both militaries is a proof that the deal is a result of back-channel negotiations and may have a better chance to last. Should it hold, the new agreement may be a big deal for India and Pakistan, and arguably for the whole world.
The recent India-Pakistan ceasefire agreement along the so-called line of control has brought relative calm to border areas, which were the scenes of bloody conflicts for much of the 2020 well into this year. After over a decade of fighting since their last similar deal, the Director Generals of Military Operations of the two nations issued a rare joint statement that put into effect the cessation of hostilities since late February. The generals said from now on they want to address each other's core issues and concerns, and also envisage pullback of specialized forces that are stationed for trans-border offensive maneuvers and operations. Since their great partition, Islamabad and New Delhi have been caught in a vicious circle that has been deadly and devastating, and have come up with numerous agreements with limited longevity. But the New Deal is reported to be the result of many rounds of high-level back-channel negotiations away from the public eye, and probably many politicians. Hence, hopes are a little higher. However, their flimsy communication hotline is still in a nascent stage, and only a test of time will tell if it has the potential to create a lasting peace between the two nuclear-armed countries.
Weeks after India and Pakistan agreed on quote-unquote strict observance of the 2003 ceasefire, the pact continues to be followed on the ground with no apparent signs of violation. With the renewal of their commitment to nearly two-decade-old ceasefire along the border, the winds of change are blowing in relations of the two. But are they strong enough to turn the tide in the deep sea of distrust between the two classic adversaries?
India and Pakistan, along with other nations in South Asia, are members of a subcontinental civilizational family tied together by bonds of shared culture, religion, race, and language. The fathers of Pakistan and India wanted them to live in peace, not in permanent conflict. Mahatma Gandhi had the audacity to publicly call both India and Pakistan as his country. Although geographically and politically India is divided in two, at heart we shall be friends and brothers, helping and respecting one another and be one for the outside world, Gandhi famously said on January 26, 1948, just 4 days before his assassination at the hands of a Hindu extremist. Muhammad Ali Jinnah also desired good and neighborly relations, something he described as an association similar to that between the US and Canada. The ceasefire accord heralds a new era of Indo-Pak ties, but only if it can withstand the likely setbacks along the way. There are multitudes of concurring or conflicting forces, both in support and opposition of the new momentum for peace, from inside the two countries, militaries, parliaments or administrations, along with regional and international players with some stake in the game.
If there is a peace, of course, the whole region will enjoy, the whole region will develop, the whole region will welcome. Against this, if there is any confrontation, because India and Pakistan both are the nuclear states and they have the capabilities to destroy each other completely. That will be disaster not only for India and Pakistan but for the whole region. The peace is only hope and the hope for the Asia, for the whole region. I believe that all other countries in the Asia, they will appreciate and they will like it.
The timing of the newly achieved agreement was the source of a lot of contentious speculations in itself. It happened after months of secret talks, but suspiciously around at the same time India reached a somehow similar deal with China. This has caused many to question Beijing's role during the back-channel meetings. Another touchy subject purportedly linked to the ceasefire is the election of Joe Biden into the White House. Many argue that if Donald Trump had managed to stay in office, such an agreement would never have been clinched.
Given the hype in expectations and the special discourse and circumstances around the ceasefire, the agreement seems more than a strategic maneuver or a solitary move, with the impression that it is only the first step in a longer peace process. The announcement could not have emerged without top-notch diplomatic work by the two governments, and probably with some help from others. The influence of Beijing on the deal, or where China stands in this complex geopolitical equation, has remained unclear, but the timing of the agreement indicates a high correlation, as the Indo-Pak deal was publicized following another Himalayan de-escalation effort in the India-China border areas. In any conceivable scenario, the future of the new treaty will be intertwined with the dynamics of the two countries' relations with China. Another external factor with considerable weight on the ceasefire can be the new U.S. administration. India wants China contained, but does not want to do the job itself. When Donald Trump was in office, Premier Narendra Modi was certain of Washington's harsh approach towards Beijing. But with Joe Biden at the helm, India needs new tactics to control the extent of interactions between its two main rivals, Pakistan and China.
Washington is far away from this region, and we do not know how much interest they have in the peace in this region. But of course, they are close allied with India. They are bound in Quad Alliance with Japan, Australia, India, and America. They, of course, are very much concerned about India, about Pakistan. We were close allies with the Western world during the Cold War, but since for last couple of decades, Washington was keeping distance from Pakistan and tilting toward India more and more.
Last year was the worst year since the 2003 ceasefire, as the two armies recorded about 5,000 bouts of skirmishes in border areas. But worst year for whom? Many of the killed or injured people are not even from the two countries' militaries. Most of them are the innocent inhabitants of the border villages stuck in a decades-long political conundrum, mainly over Kashmir. Indian and Pakistani authorities have often described the Kashmir issue as their only real problem. But can this new deal solve the issue of Kashmir forever?
Since their independence from British colonial rule in 1947, India and Pakistan have fought many wars, with regular fatal scuffles across the tumultuous borders. Almost all the efforts to bring peace and normalcy have crumbled with no breakthrough, mostly due to their irreconcilable positions on Kashmir. The Indian government abrogated the special constitutional status of Jammu and Kashmir in 2019, making the would-be independent Kashmir a federally controlled territory. For Islamabad, Kashmir is essential to the idea of Pakistan's creation, and any acceptance of the new status quo is bound to be seen as letting down the Kashmir cause. Unless India and Pakistan reach an understanding on the way forward in their Kashmir policies, the people of Kashmir will be the actual sufferers of the new diplomatic feat. Any future for the virtually non-existent bilateral relationship between India and Pakistan is only imaginable if they find a solution for Kashmir. A united Asia is only possible with a balanced triangle of power among China, India, and Pakistan, in addition to close cooperation with other powerhouses like Russia and Iran. This is not a reality yet, not until a solution is found for Kashmir.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Ravi Nitesh. He's a social activist and the founder of Aghaz-e-Dosti. Mr. Nitesh, welcome to the show. So, there have been ceasefires throughout the history between India and Pakistan. Do you think this one would beg to differ and last?
Actually, what we see that first of all, this ceasefire pact that happened between the DGMOs of India and Pakistan is definitely a positive step. Whether it is different from the past or not is a separate question, because this is not the first ceasefire pact. Actually, ceasefire goes into the history since 1949, when the ceasefire line was drawn between India and Pakistan, and it followed in 1972 Simla Agreement, when the ceasefire line converted into line of control. And even after that, when in 1999 the Kargil conflict happened between India and Pakistan, then the ceasefire violations goes up to very high level. And even after that, in 2003, there was a ceasefire agreement between the government of India and government of Pakistan. And after the 2003 ceasefire agreement, there is a drastic lowering down of ceasefire violations incidents. If you will see the numbers, you will find that in 2002, there were more than 8,000 ceasefire violations happened in 1 year. While after the agreement happened between government of India and Pakistan at the time of Vajpayee and Musharraf, so at that time, in 2004, it drastically goes to nil. And then again, from the 2003 to 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, it goes to normal. And after 2012-13, it again started increasing. 2013, there was again a DGMO ceasefire promise that they will follow the ceasefire. 2018, again DGMOs promised each other that they will follow the ceasefire. And now it is 2021. Because this year, if we will see 2020, there were more than 5,100 ceasefire violations. And when it comes to the human cost, it is huge and huge. So what I see that this is definitely a positive step, but frankly, I don't see that it is very different from the historical ceasefire agreements that happened in the past, but always denied and violated.
All right, so you think that it's a positive step, but it won't make much difference. So, moving ahead, Indian and Pakistani authorities have often described the issue of Kashmir as their only real problem. Can this new deal solve the issues in Kashmir?
No, I definitely don't think that this new deal can solve the problem. But definitely, if there are ceasefire violations, then it is means very highlighted issue on both the sides. And if the local population will be affected and the local environment will be unstable, then definitely there can be no other talks. So if ceasefire agreement has happened, even if between the DGMOs, which is only army sites on both the sides, it's army ranks, DGMOs. And when DGMO agreed that ceasefire will be observed, then definitely the government's diplomatic and political channels can become active to talk on other issues, including the Kashmir. Because Kashmir is not the only issue on both the sides. There are many other issues, including Kashmir. So it can help in creating a positive environment